From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
You know the nighttime now. Holiday. Is the right time.
Holiday.
To be.
Holiday.
With the one you love now.
Holiday. On this Valentine's Day edition of Fresh Air, some love songs from the king of bad taste, John Waters, the independent filmmaker best known for Pink Flamingos, and Hairspray, which was adapted into the hit Broadway musical, has put together a CD of his favorite love songs. We'll play a few and talk with him about romance. Then we'll hear a couple of songs about heartbreak, and Willie Nelson will tell us about writing them. Also, our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how we send Valentines, phone, card, or email. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you want to celebrate Valentine's Day without getting too sugary, you've come to the right place. We're going to hear some love songs selected by John Waters, the independent filmmaker who became famous for bad taste with his 1972 midnight movie classic Pink Flamingos. When his 1988 movie Hairspray was adapted into a hit Broadway musical, he crossed over to the mainstream. That doesn't mean he's given up on transgressive movies. He now describes himself as a filthy elder. He's put together a new CD of his favorite love songs. The collection is called A Date with John Waters. Some of the tracks are really strange. Some of them are really great. Before we talk with Waters about love, let's hear Shirley and Lee. They're best known for their 1956 recording, Let the Good Times Roll. This is Bewildered. I asked John Waters why he included this track on his CD, A Date with John Waters.
I'm a huge fan of Shirley and Lee. This song was mostly known as a signature song by James Brown. I had never heard Shirley sing this. Shirley and Lee, of course, had big hits with I Feel Good and Let the Good Times Roll in the 50s. But they sang many, many, many other songs. And I think she was the first person that introduced the nasal voice, female vocal, that went on to maybe Kathy Lyndon, A Thousand Stars in the Sky, and Angel Baby. And I just am so happy that Shirley never took a cold pill that day, or maybe they didn't have cold pills in the 50s.
There's a great old photo of you on the cover of your new CD, A Date with John Waters, and it's you kind of, it looks like you're reclining with a very kind of come-hither look.
Yes. I've been saving that picture. Yeah, my dirty collar. Everybody's pointed out the white collar is very dirty on that jacket. Well, it did come from a thrift shop. That was at the Deauville Film Festival, the first time I ever went to France in probably about 76. And it was taken by Marcia Resnick, who very much covered the punk rock scene in those days in New York. And I've had that picture in a box for since then, thinking one day I'll use this for something.
Did she pose you like this?
Well, I don't remember. It was a whole photo shoot. I don't remember really. I do remember that Gloria Swanson was at that film festival when she was still alive. And I watched her in action so amazingly. When you talked to her, there was paparazzi around always with her. But she would never pretend that they were there. But she would put her face up to cover unflattering angles that she could see they were talking. So it looked like she was doing kabuki when she was talking to you. But she never acknowledged there were photographers there. But she would just block her face if she could see they were taking it from an unflattering angle. So maybe she affected me that way. I don't know.
What was your idea of romantic sophistication like when you were young?
When I was young, certainly Hollywood movies, certainly Douglas Sirk, really. His movies were melodramas, and at the time they were made fun of by the critics. They were called women's pictures, and they were always with Lana Turner and Rock Hudson, and people went blind, or people could never get back to the one they loved. And I think, as much as I love Douglas Sirk's movies, he damaged all of us from our generation, because we believe this is what love should be like, when of course it couldn't be. And I finally did meet Douglas Sirk way later in life at the Berlin Film Festival with Fassbinder. And they were the oddest couple, but they actually hung out. And I think Fassbinder made Douglas Sirk famous again by praising his movies and remaking some of them. And that's why I put on this album the theme song to Imitation of Life, which is probably one of Sirk's most famous movies. And the title song by Earl Grant, that album has been out of print for many, many years, and collectors have been looking for that song. So that's why I put it on here. It's a good makeout song. It's a good song to drink and miss somebody by. I had a friend that used to drink heavily in my apartment and play the song over and over and over, missing his ex-boyfriend. So I think it's a good song for that. It's a good Valentine song.
And before we hear it, I mean, just say a little bit about what the plot is like from this 1959 movie.
Imitation of Life. Let me think now. It's Lana Turner. She's poor, and then she becomes a movie star, and she claws her way to the top, always with her maid. And her maid has a daughter who passes for white and falls in love with Troy Donahue, and he finds out she's black. And there's lots of racial tension all through it. And it's a real weepy when the maid dies, and the funeral at the end of Imitation of Life is the most over-the-top, tear-jerking, melodramatic funeral with Mahalia Jackson wailing in the background. It's actually what I want my funeral to be like.
Well, let's hear the theme. We're not going to think about that too much. Let's hear the theme from Imitation of Life, and this is Earl Grant.
What is love without forgiving? Without love, you're only living an imitation of life. Skies above in flaming color, without love, they're so much duller. A false creation, an imitation of life.
Now, when you were loving these Douglas Sirk movies when you were young, do you think that they became an influence on your filmmaking? And I'll give you an example of a place in which I think Douglas Sirk was definitely an influence, and that's in Polyester, in the character that Divine played, who is this like long suffering housewife whose husband turns out to be no good, but she has a big heart, and she's going through all these like trials, and she's misled by a handsome young man. And
completely, it's the movie that I did that was the most like Douglas Sirk. Even the opening of coming in, going over the neighborhood, and with Tab Hunter and Debbie Harry singing together. It was the movie. You know, many of the Douglas Sirk movies I didn't really see as a child. I saw them later in life when making my movies myself, when I was an adult. So he's influenced so many young filmmakers. I mean, you know, what was the movie Todd made, the remake, Far From Heaven? That was very much
great.
A Douglas Sirk movie. Yeah. And so that you're right. That is the movie, most of mine, that was heavily influenced by Douglas Sirk. And we all watched the movies before we made them. And it was the first time that Divine played a real character. We had established this fictitious character of Divine that was kind of Jane Mansfield and Godzilla put together. And then it was a shock to people to see him playing a fairly unattractive, miserable, weak housewife. But she started to get very good reviews because it was such an against-type role, but very much a Douglas Sirk character, yes.
Did you see Douglas Sirk's movies as unintentional camp or as really great filmmaking?
I think they're really great filmmaking. I think Douglas Sirk always knew they were ironic, but the style of the movies, the reflections and the artificial light that's coming from nowhere and all the mirror shots and that great shot where she's just looking in the television lonely and reflects her own face in it. And I think that he was a very, very good filmmaker. I think Andrew Saras was the first critic that ever actually praised him. He was in the 50s. Always got bad reviews. And then Fassbinder, I think, is the one that completely was responsible for the revival of Douglas Sirk. And I think today he is many, many young filmmakers. You can see the influence of Douglas Sirk's films.
Well, my guest is filmmaker John Waters, and he has a new CD that's a compilation of love songs, falling in and falling out of love. And the CD is called A Date with John Waters. Let's listen to another track from your CD, and I thought we could play Johnny, Are You Queer? Tell us something about why you chose this and who's performing it.
Well, it seems like a fair question on an album with me. The only girls that come on to me anymore are biker girls. For some reason, they don't get it. And I'm always... when they're rubbing up on me, I think, haven't you heard by now? Yeah. But they haven't, I guess. Or maybe they think that they're going to change. I don't know. So I think it's a great, funny song that's a really fair date today. Most women I know that ended up in the arts as actresses, most heterosexual women, their first boyfriend was gay. And they're not sorry about that. They became friends, and then they moved on and found a great straight boyfriend. But I think it's a very common question today to ask if a girl likes a guy. Hey, are you queer, by the way? Just tell me now. I mean, it seems a fair question today as part of dating.
Okay, well, let's hear Johnny, Are You Queer? Featuring Josie Cotton. Johnny, Are You Queer? One of the tracks on John Waters' new CD compilation, which is called A Date with John Waters. And it's a follow-up to an album he had a couple of years ago of his favorite and unusual Christmas songs. since your album is all about love, yep. And I mean, can I ask you, like, when you knew you were gay?
Probably the first time I saw Elvis Presley. And my parents were appalled. I mean, before he was really famous, when he was a rock and roll hillbilly, when he first came out on Louisiana Hayride, those days, I thought, oh my God, it's a space alien, something here. But I felt something that I realized that I was maybe responding in a way that was not typical to the other boys in my class. Let's say I paid more attention to Elvis than the baseball game.
Do you have like a coming out story of like when you told your parents and what their reaction was?
No, that's like coming out's too corny for me, really. I just figured everybody knew, really. I was always amazed. I was on the cover of a paper called Gay Times in about 1972 or something when Pink Flamingos came out. So I don't know. I always just assumed, well, you saw my movies. But to me, I never fit in the gay world either. I still don't.
In what sense do you feel like you don't?
Well, I've never been to the gym. I have no desire to. I want to look like a junkie. I like women, too, for friends. Many of my friends are straight. I don't know. I don't like to dance in public. There's lots of things that I don't fit in. But I always like all minorities that don't get along with their other minorities, because then you really have a sense of humor. So I like bars that are totally mixed, straight, gay, undecided. And that is more fun to me, because then it's more interesting.
My guest is filmmaker John Waters. His new CD is a collection called A Date with John Waters. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is independent filmmaker John Waters. He's best known for his midnight movie classic Pink Flamingos and for his movie Hairspray, which was adapted into the hit Broadway musical. He's put together a CD of his favorite love songs called A Date with John Waters. So I want to play another selection from your compilation, A Date with John Waters. And this time I thought we'd play something by somebody who you've worked with a lot, and it's the actress Mink Stoll. And the song is Sometimes I Wish I Had a Gun. Tell us a little about her and your working relationship with her. She's been in most of your movies before we hear the record.
Mink has been in every one of my movies, I believe, since Mondo Trasho. She might have missed one when she lived in a different city. But she has always been the character actress in all my films. She was usually pitted against Divine, and Divine usually won. Divine killed her many times in my movie. She's been around forever. Her real name was Nancy Stoll, and I knew her. I lived with her in a tree fort in Provincetown is how we first met. And Mink was great. I mean, I never knew that Mink sang, though. This new song, where I think she sings really well, is brand new. I mean, she's doing this singing right now. She lives in Los Angeles. And she sent me this, and I had no idea that she could sing like this. I knew Mink could act. I knew Mink was funny. I knew Mink could do a lot of things. But I never knew she could sing in kind of a Julie London kind of way. So I was thrilled to put her on the album. And as I say, I don't think there's any songs on this album that are campy. Even Edith Massey. I don't think anybody is going to think Mink's song is campy. But maybe Edith Massey, who sings Big Girls Don't Cry. But to me, campy is so bad it's good, and the same with my Christmas album. I didn't pick any of these songs because I think they're bad. And in Mink's case, I was just kind of wowed by her talent. I think she's great.
Well, let's hear it. This is Mink Stoll singing Sometimes I Wish I Had a Gun.
Sometimes I wish I had a gun so you and I could be alone. You'd be my hostage for the day and you'd do just what I say. I'd aim it at your arms and make you wrap them round. I'd aim it at your lips and make you say you love me. I'd aim it at your eyes, give a look of love, and we'd be happy, baby. Sometimes I wish I had a gun. Sometimes I wish I had a gun. Whenever you go walking by, you wouldn't give me that look when my gun caught your eye. I'd aim it at your arms, you'd wrap them round me. I'd aim it at your lips and make you want to kiss me. I'd aim it at your eyes, you'd give a look of love, and we'd be happy, baby. Sometimes I wish I had a gun.
Well, since we just heard from Mink Stoll, who you've worked with in a lot of your movies, I thought this would be a good time to pay tribute to Van Smith, who was a makeup artist for a lot of your films, and he died in December.
He was more really the costume designer.
Costume designer, yeah.
He did makeup, too. He did makeup up to the end, but I think he was most famous for the costumes. He did Divine's fishtail gown and pink flamingos, Ricky Lake's roach dress. He did the costumes from every movie from Pink Flamingos up until A Dirty Shame, and he was going to do my next movie with me. He was a dear friend. He was, I always joke, the Mount Rushmore behind my films was Van Smith for the costume, Vincent Perenio for the production design, and Pat Moran for casting. And I hope I get obituaries that were as amazing as his. I mean, the New York Times said he was a terrorist and an artist. Boy, that's a good review.
Yeah,
they were pretty great, and he died just of a heart attack. He's the only person I ever knew that got a pacemaker 10 years ago and never went back to the doctor and continued to smoke. So it wasn't the best health advice, but the doctor told him if he continued to smoke, he would be dead in a year, and he continued to smoke and lasted 10 years. So oddly enough, Van didn't even know he died. He just dropped dead. But he was a major, major person in my films, and I owe him great credit for whatever success I've had.
How did you meet him?
I met Van. He went to the Maryland Institute, and he knew some of the people. I took LSD with him, if you really want to know the truth, is how I met him.
And when you took LSD together, what was the trip like? Were you talking about movies or...?
Well, gee, I don't remember. You know, when the LSD we took, you were the chair. let's just say that it wasn't just Van and myself. It was Divine, David Lockery, Pat Moran, many of the people that were the nucleus of the making of my films. And Van was an art student at the time. And I remember two of the things that Van did was he really was responsible for Divine's look. And I said to him once, just do something weird to his hairline. And Van Ken was the one that thought up shaving his hairline back, basically to leave more room for eye makeup. Van believed that the human face did not have enough space on it for the eyebrows that he wanted to put on. And another thing I remember, when Divine was still Glenn Milstead and didn't completely believe he was Divine yet, I had moved to San Francisco, and then the films had caught on, Mondo Trasho and Multiple Maniacs at the Palace Theater. And a guy named Sebastian, who was the promoter there, a great guy, said, bring Divine out. Bring him out here, and we'll make him a star here. So he had no money. Divine was home. And I said to Van, get him. Let's do this. So Van thought up this Divine look, put Divine in full drag, put him on an airplane. He did not have one penny in his pitiful pocketbook that cost a nickel from a thrift shop. And he went to San Francisco, got off the plane, was received by the Coquettes, that were a bearded transvestite group very popular in San Francisco at the time. And he never went back. He was Divine from then on. And I think Van gave Divine confidence to believe that he could really do this. And I think that was very, very important.
You know, you mentioned that when you first met Van Smith, you were all tripping. And there's parts of Pink Flamingos that are really like a very bad trip.
Or a very good trip.
Well, in your opinion.
Certainly we weren't tripping when we made those movies. That would have been impossible.
Yeah.
You know, my mother always says, don't tell LSD stories to young people. But basically, nothing bad happened to me on LSD. If I had a child today and they told me they were taking LSD, I'd be uptight. But it gave me confidence in a weird way. But many friends maybe that I took LSD with at the time went on and became drug addicts and are dead. So, but I think the experiences we had certainly did give some influence on the look of Divine, certainly. And when we used to take LSD, Divine would come in unshaven with stubble and put a towel around his head like a hat and shower curtain rings, his earrings, and do Dionne Warwick's entire album while we were tripping while the acid was coming off. So it was an experience you do remember. Let's put it that way.
Van Smith must have designed a lot of really great, like cheap, because you didn't have much of a budget, makeup and designs for the people in
your
movie.
But the thing was, the tradition was, that Van and I joked about, on every movie, including the last one, there was a tradition that one of the stars cried when they saw their costumes the first day. It always happened. We waited to see who it would be.
Give me an example.
Ruth Brown in Hairspray, Christina Ricci in Pecker. You know, really, I can go through each movie. And they said, I'm not wearing this. Oh my God. And Divine would always. And Van, this is how he was so good with talent. He would say, shut up, you're wearing it. And they didn't know what to say.
John Waters will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble. With the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA Cref, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at tiaacref.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jeff Nunberg on Valentine's Day cards, Willie Nelson on writing songs about heartbreak, and more with John Waters.
My heart, and you made me cry. You hurt me when you were around, but now I'm back to let you know you'll never keep this big girl down.
Yeah, girls, don't cry, la, la.
They don't cry.
Yeah, girls, don't cry.
Who says they don't cry? We'd have to break up. I thought that he would call my bluff. When he said to my surprise, big girls don't cry.
Big girls don't cry.
They don't cry.
Big girls don't cry.
Who says they don't cry?
Big
you made me cry. You hurt me when you were around. But now...
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Waters, the independent filmmaker who made his reputation as the king of bad taste with his 1972 film Pink Flamingos. His 1988 film Hairspray was adapted into the hit Broadway musical. He's put together a CD of his favorite love songs called A Date with John Waters. Let's pick up where we left off. So you said earlier that when you were young, you got your idea of romantic sophistication from movies, particularly Douglas Sirk's movies. What other movies really helped you develop your idea of what romantic love was like?
Well, I don't say they developed it in a healthy way, but certainly Peyton plays, The Bramble Bush, those kind of movies, The Carpetbaggers, anything that Tennessee Williams wrote was really a huge, huge influence on me, certainly. Even the movies they made of his where they took out all the good parts and had to change it. So certainly I was always impressed by doomed love, and that's what most movies were about. Melodrama is always about that. So I think mental health is later in life realizing that you don't want that in your life. Basically, if you can see that, I believe that John Money, who was a sexologist, a very famous one in Baltimore who died recently, he coined the phrase love maps, that everybody has a type and you're going to continue to go to that type for the rest of your life. But if that type brings you pain, all your mental health is you can see it coming and you decide whether you want that pain or you avoid it. I don't think anybody completely changes. I think that you learn to make peace with your neuroses, and certainly you learn how to deal with them, and you don't let them make you unhappy. That's my mental health.
Is there a certain type that you've learned not to not to fall for?
Well, anybody that says to me they want to go to a premiere with me is a bad date, basically. the kind I love, and they say, I've never really seen some of your movies. That's great romance to me. I can fall in love then. Because then, they don't want to be in the movie. They don't want to go to a premiere with you. I mean, going to a premiere is work. I usually think that being plus one in that situation is a fairly uncomfortable evening. And for me, I have to worry if that person's having fun or not, or they're feeling left alone. Or, the photographers sometimes yell, date, step out. Which is really rude if they're not famous. Or sometimes they yell if I'm with somebody younger than me, is that your son, John? And I would say, yeah, it is. Yeah, just say anything. I don't care. But when I've heard them say that, date, step out. God, talk about rude.
Well, I've been choosing the records. It's your turn. I want you to choose something from A Date with John Waters.
Well, to me, let me think, something... I'm trying to think of one that is underplayed on the album, certainly. How about Clarence Frogman? No, how about, I know one. I think one that would be great on your show because it's the most upbeat one. It's the most crazy one to me. It's called If I Knew You Were Coming, I'd Bake a Cake. And that is what I feel like. The next morning, if you're with somebody and you had a great night and everything, and you get up in the morning, and it's like an insane woman in 1950. If she knew later that she was having an affair and somebody really cute was coming over and she has to make food because she's too nervous to be around the kitchen. And that's what it sounds like. So I really like this song. And I've read a lot about the woman who sings it, Eileen Barton, who I knew nothing about. And for a while on YouTube, there is an old really, and I found this out way after I had picked her to be on the album, a great shot of her on very early television, like a kinescope, lip syncing the song while she makes a cake with two children behind her. And she only died last year. And of course, like all the stars from this era, she claims she never got one penny for the song or anything, which is always very, very sad. But hey, I bought the record in the right way. So I didn't rip her off. But I just wish sometimes a lot of these singers that I picked on the song, I did research on them afterwards and found out they all just died within the last year or two. And so I kind of wished I had met them. But at the same time, Eileen Barton might have thought, well, who's John Waters? And then Google me and think, oh my God, this is the last person I want my record associated with.
Well, I'm glad you explained why you chose her, because I was going to ask you, because it seems like, what is this track doing on here? So now we know. Let's hear it. This is Eileen Barton singing If I Knew You Were Coming, I'd Have Baked a Cake.
Come in. Well, 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 look who's here. I haven't seen you in many a year. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake, baked a cake, baked a cake. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. How'd you do, how'd you do, how'd you do?
you a letter, I'd have hired a band and spread the welcome mat for you. Oh, I don't know where you came from, 'cause I don't know where you've been, but it really doesn't matter. Grab a chair and fill your platter and dig, dig, dig right in. If I knew you were coming, I'd...
That's music from John Waters' new CD, A Date with John Waters, which is a collection of love songs that he's chosen. John, I always knew that song because, like, my mother always used to hum it and sing it a little bit.
Yeah, well, you,
I'm not
it,
sure
you
I never heard
able...
the original before.
But I bet that you will hum that song accidentally later today after hearing it. You can't get it out of your head, and that's what makes a hit, really. And I believe this is probably from the same genre that was Rosemary Clooney, Come On to My House, Come On, Come On. It seems like that kind of song, mm-hmm. which is peppy and crazy and so wholesome that she might just spontaneously combust in the kitchen and just splatter all over the wall.
One of the current developments in your life is that the film musical adaptation of the Broadway musical adaptation of your movie Hairspray is coming this summer with John Travolta in the role of the mother that Divine originated and Harvey Fierstein played on Broadway.
Yep.
So it's kind of like the producers in the sense that, like, the movie inspired the Broadway musical, which inspired a musical based on...
Well, it's different, though.
Here's why I think it's different.
Because the movie of the producers was very much the exact play of the producers.
Right.
For this to work, it has to be reinvented again, which I've only read the script, and it seems like it had to be. The Broadway musical reinvented my original movie, and I think the new movie of Hairspray has to reimagine and reinvent the musical, which I think it has. I was on the set. I'm in it. I play the Flasher, of course. And I sat with Mr. Travolta in the trailer as he got into drag, which was the experience is not that different from Harvey or Divine doing. It's still a long process. I have high hopes for it. Who knows? I don't know what it's going to be like. But Crybaby's coming to Broadway now, so you never know what's going to happen to them. They seem to, at least my films last. None of them are giant hits when they come out, but they're like in publishing what they call a backlist. They stay in print. They're in box sets. They come out in every country. They're re-released, and you just can't get rid of them.
Have you had no involvement in the screen adaptation outside of being in it?
Well, they asked me to call John Travolta to talk him into it, which I did.
What'd you tell him?
Well, I just talked to him about the role, how basically it was a role that both Divine and Harvey did as... approached it very much as a character role, and because Divine said the thing in the very beginning that was true: no one can call me a drag queen. What drag queen would allow themselves to look like this? Basically, it's an anti-drag queen drag role. Basically,
like frumpy homemaker.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the first day on the set when Divine was dressed like that, I didn't recognize him. And the real housewives in the community were saying, "Hi, do you believe they're making a movie?" Talking to him, they just thought he was one of them. They didn't even recognize him. So I think that, and John Travolta talked about how he grew up in New Jersey, so he was younger than me, but his sister was my age and wore a beehive and was from a similar community as Baltimore, of East Baltimore, where this was. So I think he understood it, and he was great. He was a funny guy on the phone, that's all. And New Line wanted me, certainly. I showed Adam Shankman, the director. I had meetings with all the people that were doing the costumes, the makeup, and they came to Baltimore, and I showed them all the neighborhoods. I gave them the tour. And so I've been involved that way from the very beginning with the producers and everything. But I didn't want to write it. I made that movie. I made that movie already, and I'm proud of it, and I was involved in the musical, and I hope this is a big hit.
Now, you live in Baltimore, and that's where Hairspray's set, and, you know, I know you probably have other places, too, but you're still partly based in Baltimore.
No, I'm completely. Well, it's my house, my office, everything is there. My inspiration is there.
Yeah, and now, you know, Baltimore for the past few years has been home of the HBO series The Wire, and I was wondering if you ever, you know, go on the set or if you're interested in the series or anything.
Well, certainly I think it's the best show on television. Certainly many of the people that started with me are the main people on that show. Vincent Perenio, who built the trailer for Pink Flamingos for $100, is the production designer of that show.
Huh.
Pat Moran, who has cast me from the very beginning, cast the show.
Really?
She won the Emmy for Homicide. Most of the crew has worked with me. So, yeah, I know everybody on the show. I'm friends with David Simon. I think it's a great, great show. And the only person I have to argue with sometimes is the mayor, who's now the governor, who always is worried about the image of Baltimore from the show. And I always tell them, when I'm away and I see those crack houses, I'm homesick. You know, not everyone likes tall ships. I hate tall ships. So, you know, not everybody wants to come. Think of it. Everybody that Barry Levinson has made movies about, anti-Semitism, aluminum, you know, home improvement, rip-off salesman. I've made movies about killer housewives. The television shows are about junkies. But everybody likes the extremes of Baltimore. That seems to be what's interesting all creative people about the city, because it is an extreme city, but in a good way. It doesn't care about anybody else. It can't imagine why you would want to leave. People say, they're moving to New York, and people say, why? They're amazed by that, which I think is kind of great and touching. And we have managed to embrace the things that many cities' chamber of commerce used to hide, and we've embraced them with humor. And I think that's why the city is such a good place to live.
Well, I want to close with another track from your CD compilation, A Date with John Waters, and I thought we could choose the opening track, which is by far the sweetest. And
scariest.
And it's Patience and Prudence singing Tonight You Belong to Me. Tell us why you chose it.
Well, I chose it because it was the first record I ever shoplifted, which is always a personal magic memory. But at the same time, I think they're scary almost. They're almost like I loved Rhoda Penmark and The Bad Seed as a child, and this is kind of my visualization of them. Or also Damien or any of these Children of the Damned, any of these singers. And they're so sweet, and they're singing a song called Tonight You Belong to Me, which is a little inappropriate for a child song. I've read later that they were very angry that their father was, I think, owned the record company, and he wouldn't let them go on Ed Sullivan. And when I was doing a signing in L.A., one of them said that Prudence still lives in L.A. and is bitter. So I don't know what that means. But I hope that if Prudence, if you're living, you've been a huge influence on me. It was the first song I ever taught my little sister. I used to play when she was a baby, the first music she ever responded to. So it's been a song that's been in my life from very early memories, and I've always had great ones about it.
John Waters, it's really great to talk with you again.
Thank you.
John Waters' new CD of love songs is called A Date with John Waters. Coming up on this Valentine's Day, Willie Nelson talks about writing two songs about heartbreak. This is Fresh Air. Valentine's Day is a time to celebrate love or wallow in heartbreak. So for those of you obsessing on what went wrong, we have two songs about heartbreak, and Willie Nelson is going to tell us about writing them. Here he is on a 1961 demo recording doing his song Opportunity to Cry.
Just watch the sunrise on the other side of town. Once more I've waited, and once more you've let me down. This would be a perfect time for me to die. I'd like to take this opportunity to cry. You gave your word, now I'll return it to you. with this suggestion as to what you can do. Just exchange the words I love you to goodbye while I take this opportunity to cry. I'd like to see you. But
that's Willie Nelson and a demo recording he made of his own song in 1961 when he was trying to interest people in recording his songs. What was the fate of that song? Did anybody ever do it?
I don't think anybody done it but me. I've recorded it maybe a couple of times since then on a couple of different albums. I don't remember what they were right at the moment, but it was one of those really sad, almost pitiful songs.
You know, in talking about country songs, like country songs have certain conventions in a way. You know, like a lot of country songs are about cheating or drinking too much or falling in love. I guess you could say the same thing about rock songs. But there's also like a subcategory of country songs where like you're feeling so bad, you're just overwhelmed with self-pity. And one of the most self-pitying of the self-pitying songs is a song that you wrote that's included on your demo sessions that I really want to play and hear the story behind. And so here it comes. This is Willie Nelson singing a very self-pitying song.
If I'd only had one arm to hold you, better yet, if I'd had none at all, then I wouldn't have two arms that ache for you, and there'd be one less memory to recall. If I'd only.
Then in the next verse, you imagine having only one eye, so he'd have only one eye to cry. Did you think of
that's pitiful, isn't
it? Yes, so pitying. did you think that when you sat down to write this that you would write the ultimate self-pitying song?
Well, actually, I didn't sit down to write that one. The way that song happened, I was lying in bed with Shirley, and I woke up in the middle of the night wanting a cigarette, and her head was on my arm. So I had to reach over on the side of the bed and get a cigarette and put it in my mouth and then get a match with that one hand and then try to strike that one match. So it all started from that.
Oh, because you only had one arm? Really? Is this really what
happened? That's true. That's a true story. So from the one arm, I went into the one eye, one ear, one leg.
That's really funny. That was an excerpt of our 2006 interview with Willie Nelson.
And if I had been born with but one eye, then I'd only have one eye to cry. And if half of my heart turned to ashes, maybe half of my heartaches would die. If I'd only had one leg to stand on, then a much truer picture she'd see. Then I'd more closely resemble the half a man she made of me. The half a man she made of me.
Coming up, Valentine's Day cards. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about why we still send them. This is Fresh Air. Even in the age of email, if you were fortunate enough to receive a Valentine today, odds are it was written on paper rather than in pixels. In fact, as our linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, the history of Valentine's Day as an American holiday has always been intimately connected with our postal system.
When a new communication system is introduced, it can take a while to grasp its implications. When Thomas Edison invented his improved telephone receiver in 1877, he thought it would become a medium for broadcasting concerts and plays to remote auditoriums. For 25 years after radio was developed at the end of the 19th century, people chiefly regarded it as a means of ship-to-shore communication. And then there's the U.S. postal system. For the first half century after its founding, its main function was to circulate newspapers to a national audience. Not that you couldn't send letters, too, but the rates were much higher than for periodicals. In 1840, sending a letter from Boston to Richmond cost 25 cents a sheet, at a time when the average laborer made 75 cents a day. In fact, the postal inspectors were always on the lookout for people who sent each other newspapers at the cheaper rate and added coded personal messages by putting pinpricks in certain letters. That all changed in 1845, when Congress enacted the first in a series of laws that sharply reduced the cost of sending letters. The new rates led to a vast surge in personal correspondence. They set up a communications revolution that the historian David Henken has chronicled in an engaging new book called The Postal Age. The cheaper postage didn't simply enable Americans to keep in touch with one another in what was becoming the most mobile society on Earth. It was also used by businesses who made mass mailings of circulars and by swindlers who sent out letters promoting get-rich-quick schemes. People sent each other portraits of themselves made with a recently developed daguerreotype process. They sent seeds and sprigs to distant friends and family eager for the smells of home. And, oh yes, they also sent valentines. St. Valentine's Day was an ancient European holiday, of course. Back in England, people drew lots to divine their future mates and exchanged love notes and poetry. But before the 1840s, Puritan Americans almost completely disregarded the holiday, like the other saints' days of the Old World. But the drop in postal rates set off what contemporaries described as a Valentine mania. By the late 1850s, Americans were buying 3 million ready-made Valentines every year, paying anything from a penny to several hundred dollars for elaborate affairs adorned with gold rings or precious stones. People sent cards to numerous objects of their affection, often taking advantage of the possibilities for anonymity that the mail provided. That was alarming to moralists, who worried that the postal system in general promoted promiscuity, illicit assignations, and the distribution of pornography. Actually, they weren't entirely wrong about that. But fully half the Valentine's traffic consisted of comic or insulting cards that people sent anonymously to annoying neighbors or unpopular schoolmasters. By the time the Valentine craze tapered off a few decades later, people were sending each other cards for Christmas, Easter, and on their birthdays, as the greeting card became a fixture of American life. In a lot of ways, the development of email has followed the same course that the postal system did. For one thing, the implications of the new system weren't clearly understood at first. The first email software was designed for sending files and programs over a network. And once email and other forms of electronic communication became widely available, they were rapidly adapted to almost all the purposes that cheap mail had served. Email has ushered in a new age of personal correspondence, but it's also facilitated swindles, junk mail, pornography, and anonymous hookups and erotic connections. In short, email's used for just about everything that delighted and troubled people about the postal system in the mid-19th century. But following on the heels of cheap long-distance rates, email put the final kibosh on the personal letter. Nowadays, the only personal messages that most people will regularly go to the trouble of putting in the post are the ones that serve a ritual function, like thank you notes, letters of condolence, or greeting cards. True, you can send a Valentine electronically, and some sites will even allow you to do it anonymously, though you might want to think long and hard about plighting your troth to anybody stupid enough to open the attachment on an anonymous email. But for most of us, those kinds of messages can't do their magical work if they don't physically originate with a sender. It's like getting an electronic postcard from friends who are visiting Turkey. It may be nice to hear from them, but you're not going to print it out and stick it on your refrigerator door. Those remaining postal rituals are a vestigial sign of the allure that letters once exerted on the American imagination. In fact, letter is about the only word for correspondence that has resisted digitization. We talk about email and electronic notes and messages, but sending somebody a letter still means putting a piece of paper in an envelope. It's true that nowadays, the only pieces of paper we can expect to find in our mailboxes that still bear a handwritten signature were generally printed by Hallmark. But maybe it's appropriate that the cards that signal the opening of the postal age should be among its last remnants as it draws to a close.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. His recent book on the language of politics is called Talking Right. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you. I'm gonna write words oh so sweet, they're gonna knock me off my feet. A lot of kisses on the bottom, I'll be glad I got them. I'm gonna smile.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of In the Country of Men, a novel about a young boy living under the shadow of Gaddafi's Libya by Hisham Motter. From the Broad Foundations, encouraging entrepreneurship for the public good in education, science, and the arts at broadfoundation.org. And from Bristol Bay Productions, presenting Amazing Grace, based on the true story and song behind the abolition of the British slave trade, opens February 23rd. This is NPR, National Public Radio.